Games and Libraries Podcast, Episode 3, June 2000. Hi there, and welcome to the Games and Libraries Podcast. This is episode for June 2008. We're going to be talking about all sorts of topics related to games here. We've got some reviews, we've got discussions of serious games, of games and standards, of rating systems, of laws, of Wii, and we're also going to be talking about what's going to go on at ALA and some of the other upcoming conferences. We've got a lot of new voices on the show this week, so it's a lot of fun. This is a longer show, about 45 minutes, but a lot of different topics. We're all gearing up for ALA, and we hope to see many of you there. So, without further ado, let's get right on to the content.
Hi, this is Kelly Zernike. The 5th Annual Games for Change Festival is being held the first week of June in New York City, with featured speakers James Paul G. from Arizona State, Henry Jenkins from MIT, Chris Satchel with Microsoft Game Studios, and closing speaker Sandra Day O'Connor. For more information about this festival, go to www.gamesforchange.org. Using games for social change sounds like a great exploration for libraries. Given that most of us seek to create a more literate community through our services, coupled with the fact that the millennial generation, those born approximately between 1982 and 2000, have a high volunteer rate and are very civic-minded, this could be a great way for libraries to connect with teens and other patrons. In 2007, blogger and librarian Michelle Boulay posted about the Games for Change organization and highlighted their work about public awareness related to games. She offered suggestions for libraries to develop games to teach information literacy and models on how people could search for information better. Her blog post will be included in the source notes, and it can also be found on the Association of College and Resource Libraries blog. Some real-life examples of libraries engaging in serious games as a service follow. The New York Public Library is already partnering with Games for Change, with librarian Jack Martin, to create engaging and serious games for youth related to the library. I'm sure we'll definitely hear more about that in the near future. Gloria Reeves, school librarian with the McKinley Technology High School in Washington, D.C., presented last year at the Internet Librarian Conference on how her students used the 3D software Maya to create an introduction to the physical space of the library. Well, not exactly a game. It did create an immersive environment and was definitely dependent on teamwork to get the job done. The Shifted Librarian, www.theshiftedlibrarian.com, has numerous blog posts of libraries developing skills games to become more familiar with using the library. The Public Library of Charlotte in Mecklenburg County recently started a partnership with Global Kids and Youth Venture and a juvenile detention facility to use the immersive environment of Teen Second Life to help teens launch a real-life venture to make a difference in their community. Check out the Serious Games resource at www.seriousgamessource.com to view some online games you can try right away to introduce into your classroom or library that can begin to affect change in how you think about it. You might also want to check out the game called Immune Attack, which was developed by the Federation of American Scientists, and it's to be used with high school biology classes or even entry-level college biology classes. And that can be found at http://fas.org/immuneattack, and that will also be included in the source notes. So those are a few ideas that you can try with serious games, and feel free to share in this blog of those you have tried and those resources that you're going to try, and let us know how they went. Thanks.
I'm Jason Puckett, a library instructor and technology specialist at Emory University in Atlanta. I blog at jasonpuckett.net. I'm reviewing the game LEGO Star Wars: The Complete Saga, which I played on a Nintendo Wii. The game takes you through all six Star Wars movies, but it's a fantastically detailed LEGO version of the Star Wars universe. That is, everything's made of 3D LEGO pieces, the people, the droids, the spaceships. You get to play LEGO minifigures of possibly every Star Wars character ever, including favorites like the Jedi Master with the big forehead, the big fat alien that runs the diner, and that one silver version of C-3PO. There's lots of fighting, lots of puzzle solving, some spaceship combat, some time challenges. They've done a great job of taking the action of Star Wars and adding some real cartoon-style humor to it. It really does feel like Star Wars, just a Star Wars that doesn't take itself quite so seriously, and it's a combination that works surprisingly well. There are a million tiny, authentic design details that add to this feeling. The music and the sounds are all pure Star Wars. The lightsabers sound like lightsabers, Chewie sounds like Chewie, and R2 sounds like R2. The characters all have their own particular styles. The Jedi each have their own way of moving when they duel. C-3PO's limbs fall off when he gets hit by blaster fire, and so on. So, you start off in the Mos Eisley Cantina, from which you can step through doors that lead into each of the six movies. Each film has six levels to it, and each level has three modes: story mode, free play, and challenge mode. In story mode, you follow the story through all six movies, playing the characters that actually appear in the films at that point. For example, on Tatooine, you play Luke and Obi-Wan. But once you've completed a level in story mode, you get access to free play mode, which means that you can play the level again with any characters you've unlocked from any previous level. You need specific character types to solve some of the puzzles, like you might need a droid to unlock doors, or you might need a Jedi to move something out of the way with the Force. So you don't get to see everything the first time through until you run the level again in free play with different characters. And then finally there's challenge mode, which sends you through the level looking for hidden items before a 10-minute timer runs out. There are also bounty hunter levels, which are like hide and seek. You play a bounty hunter like Boba Fett and have to find where your target is hiding as fast as possible, and you get a payoff at the end from Jabba the Hutt. So as you play through the levels, you earn points, and then once you're back in the cantina at the end of the level, you can spend those points to buy unlockables. There are new characters, new powers, new spaceships, and there's goofy stuff like Groucho Marx disguises. There is even an unlockable Indiana Jones character if you watch the LEGO Indie trailer in a back room of the cantina. Jedi characters totally get to kick butt. They can deflect blasters with their lightsabers, they can jump higher than regular mortals, they get special moves, and of course, it wouldn't be a Star Wars game if you didn't get to use the Force. There are lots of places in the game where you need the Force to move obstacles or to get past hazards. You can use Jedi mind tricks to confuse your opponents, you can toss droids around, the Emperor gets to use Force lightning, and Vader gets to use his patented choke move. The controls are pretty easy once you've played it for a few minutes, and I would expect that kids or adults who are comfortable using the Wii won't have any trouble picking up the controls. You move with the nunchuck joystick, and you do need a nunchuck for both players. The A and B buttons are the standard jump and attack buttons. C lets you change characters when you're in story mode, and Z lets you use the Force if you're a Jedi, or it does other special moves depending on what kind of character you're playing. I found the spaceship levels a lot harder than the character levels for some reason, although the controls aren't really any more difficult, so maybe just me. I played mostly on single player, but the game is a lot more fun with two players, of course. A second player can join in at any point in the game and take over another character, so it's very easy for players to drop in and out of the game. Now, if you're planning to play this for a game night, though, be advised that you can only have two players at one time, maximum. I personally have found the replay value of this game to be through the roof. There are lots and lots of extras that I haven't even mentioned. I was discovering new stuff weeks after I started playing. I got the game in December, and I'm recording this review at the end of May, and I still haven't beaten the whole thing, all the levels, and all the different modes yet. The game's rated E10 for ages 10 and up. This being Star Wars, there is a lot of fighting in the game. but I think any kid old enough to handle the movies can handle the game just fine. The violence is a lot cartoonier and a lot less graphic than the actual Star Wars movies. It's all Lego characters wailing on Lego characters. There's no blood, but there's lots of shooting. I will reiterate Han Solo's warning that Wookiees tend to rip people's arms out of their sockets. This, of course, makes Chewbacca one of my all-time favorite Lego Star Wars characters. When a character gets killed, it falls apart into Lego pieces, and if it's a player character, it reappears a few seconds later. So the only penalty for dying in the game is losing a few points and being taken out of the action for a few seconds. There's no sexual content at all. I can't imagine anybody getting turned on by the Lego version of Leia's metal bikini. So, to sum up, it's possible that I've had more fun playing LEGO Star Wars than any other video game ever. I wouldn't have thought it possible, but it's as much fun as LEGO and as much fun as Star Wars. It even manages to make Attack of the Clones fun. I am foaming at the mouth to fork over the purchase price of LEGO Indiana Jones, which will be out by the time you hear this, and LEGO Batman, which is coming in the fall.
Hi, this is Beth Galloway, here to shed some enlightenment on the Entertainment Software Ratings Board and the Video Game Rating System. The Entertainment Software Ratings Board, or ESRB, was established in 1994. Congress told them that they had to set up a video game rating system, or the government was going to step in and do it for them, following some congressional hearings on video game violence that were instituted by Senators Lieberman and Cole, because of the types of games that were coming out at the time. As game graphics and sound kept improving, thanks to technology, that meant that the content was getting more and more realistic, and in some cases, offensive. Mortal Kombat and Doom are two games that were out in the early 90s that led to the formation of this Entertainment Software Ratings Board. The mission of the board is not just to rate games. They apply and enforce ratings, but they also have a say in advertising guidelines and online privacy principles that have been adopted by the video game industry. The ratings procedure is very similar to the way that movies get rated. It's voluntary for movie publishers to submit their films to be rated, and it's also voluntary for game publishers to submit their games to be rated. To date, there are over 15,000 rated video game titles on the Entertainment Software Ratings Board's website, ESRB.org. Publishers will submit their game, but not the entire game. So they might be submitting some demos or clips, screenshots, scripts, and excerpts of content that might match some of the content descriptors that I'm going to talk about. The reviewers, a team of three people, don't necessarily play the game or play the game all the way through and beat the game. They're supposed to make their decision based on what's supplied by that publisher. And a detailed questionnaire is also part of the package that they have to send in. They make a recommendation to the ESRB. The ESRB informs the publisher of the game's rating, and the publisher actually then has the option to produce the game as is or go back and revise it. Maybe they want a lower or higher rating, so they have the option to do that. It's submitted again for final approval. The ESRB issues a certificate, and then they take a look at the final packaging to make sure that the rating they assign and the descriptors they noted are consistent. What do those ratings look like? There's a 1-inch stamp, usually on the front of the packaging, that indicates the rating of the game. Often just a series of letters. An EC rating is a game that's appropriate for age 3 and up. It would have no offensive content. An E rating is for everyone age 6 and older. It might have minimal violence, cartoon fantasy violence, and possibly some mild language. A rating of E10 and up is for everyone ages 10 and up. More violent, more suggestive themes, that sort of thing. A game rated T would be appropriate for teens age 13 and up. And now there's a shift to crude humor, maybe minimal blood, simulated gambling, reference to suggestive kinds of themes, or possibly some infrequent, strong language. A game rated M for mature would have content that's only suitable for people ages 17 and up. More intense violence, blood and gore, sexual content, and strong language. A game for adults only would be a game that has content that's only appropriate for someone ages 18 or older. Intense or prolonged exposure to intense violence and graphic sexual content. If a game still has not had a rating determined by the ESRB, then the sticker on the front might be RP for rating pending, but usually you'll only see that on a game as it's being advertised and promoted prior to its release. Once a game comes out, if they have submitted it to the Entertainment Software Ratings Board, it'll have a sticker on it. So you flip over the game, and on the back of the package, the rating symbol, EC, E, E10 and up, T, M, or AO, is repeated along with a few content descriptors. There are over 30 content descriptors, and sometimes they are modified with words like mild, strong, or intense. And I'm just going to read through a couple of them. Each of the content descriptors is, say, 2 to 4 words, and then it's followed by an actual description. Those descriptions aren't on the game packaging, so you would have to go online to esrb.org and take a look at those descriptors to get the full reference. So a content descriptor might say animated blood, crude humor, and language, and that's it. The descriptor on the website will say that animated blood means the game has discolored or unrealistic depictions of blood, that crude humor is depictions or dialogue involving vulgar antics, including, quote, bathroom humor, and that language could be mild to moderate use of profanity. What those content descriptors don't necessarily tell you is, well, is the animated blood discolored or unrealistic? Is the crude humor a depiction or a dialogue? It really could be either. Is the language mild or moderate? Because those two things could be really different. So further investigation might be required as you're looking at some of these content descriptors. There's also no indication for whether exposure to the content is required to meet the goals and objectives of the game. A popular game in libraries is Dance Dance Revolution. It's rated T for teen, and the reason given is often mild lyrics or suggestive content. So that might mean that some of the lyrics might have mild references to profanity, sexuality, violence, alcohol, or drug use within the music. Hearing "Hey Baby" in a song may not be offensive to most people. So the lyrics aren't so much an issue, but the suggestive themes, references to sex or sexuality, may be offensive. In the version that I bring to libraries, one of the dancers is sort of scantily clad in bright red hot pants, and she dances face forward, so you mostly see her wiggling behind. For some people, that kind of visual descriptor is much more offensive than the language in the music. So part of understanding those content descriptors is also understanding what's going to work in your community and what people are going to get more upset over, and being comfortable with talking with parents about what those descriptors mean. I think we need to make it really clear that the ratings for video games have nothing to do with difficulty or ability to beat the game, that a six-year-old, actually my six-year-old nephew, can pick up a Guitar Hero controller and play the game. The content and the language in the game might be way over his head. He's probably not even paying attention to the "Hey Baby" kinds of music, but it's still not necessarily content-wise an appropriate game for a six-year-old to play, which is why I pick the songs and only play with him in a supervised environment. It's a strategy that a librarian who's on the LibGaming Google email discussion group has employed. Actually, they used it to limit song length for Guitar Hero. They cut out songs that were more than 10 minutes and put all these shorter titles in the coffee can of rock. So kids had a limited selection of songs to play. And I think this could be a really good strategy. You don't have to play all of the songs with strong lyrics to win the game, necessarily. The Entertainment Software Ratings Board's website, again, esrb.org, can be used as a collection development tool. I think if you're talking about a collection of games for children's room, then keeping games that are under that T for teen rating is a smart idea. If you're starting a teen collection, making sure that you're not collecting M-rated games is a smart idea. And the ESRB's database is a really good place to check that. They've included some other great tools online for librarians, parents, and educators to access. You can actually put a search widget right on your library's website to enable parents to search video game titles to see what the content was rated. They also have a list of further resources, links to websites that both review family-friendly games and links to websites that include screenshots, detailed reviews, and demos so that parents can feel more armed with information about exactly what the content in the game is about. So do check out esrb.org for more information about the video game rating system and procedure.
Hello, this is Christopher Harris, and the school section of the Games and Libraries podcast this month is brought to you by the letters A, A, S, L, and the number 64. That's the number of AASL standards for the 21st century learner that were aligned to gaming practices. The member librarians of the school library system of Genesee Valley BOCES worked to align gaming to these new standards that the American Association of School Librarians put out. The AASL standards are heavily defined by inquiry-based learning, critical thinking, drawing conclusions, applying knowledge, but also ethical behavior and aesthetic growth for an individual. What we're trying to show is that games are a great fit for school libraries, that they meet the curriculum standards, that they're another type of instructional resource that libraries can provide to support learning within the classroom, but that they also represent entertainment value. Now, I know that this view differs greatly from the views held by other people discussing gaming in libraries, where they say that games need to not be aligned to the curriculum, that they need to not be based on classroom usage, that they really need to be focused purely on that entertainment enjoyment value. While I certainly wish things could work this way, while I wish that school libraries could purchase materials and start new programs that were really focused on that personal and aesthetic growth that the AASL standards call for, I also understand that in this age of accountability, in this age of declining school budgets, there are certain requirements that must be met. These new items being purchased in the libraries, these new programs being proposed, must match with the curriculum. They must address the standards, and they must be able to show that they're leading to higher student achievement. And I certainly believe that games fit the bill here. That's why we work to show that they are aligned with the AASL standards. But we didn't stop there. Brian Mayer, who works at the school library system, went further and aligned some of the games in our game library with the New York State learning standards. And so we're able to show teachers that if you're teaching to standard 4 in social studies, here are games that address that standard. New York State Social Studies Standard 4 is economics. It reads, students will use a variety of intellectual skills to demonstrate their understanding of how the United States and other societies develop economic systems and associated institutions to allocate scarce resources, how major decision-making units function in the U.S. and other national economies, and how an economy solves the scarcity problem through market and non-market mechanisms. To address this, we're recommending use of the Settlers of Catan series, or the Great Game Puerto Rico. Both of these games deal with scarcity of resources. In Catan, you have whatever resources you're able to settle around, and whatever comes up on the die roll. In Puerto Rico, you just don't have enough turns to get everything done, and so you have to decide where are you going to focus your efforts. In Puerto Rico, you also work on major decision-making units. Are you going to take the builder? Are you going to take the prospector? What role are you going to play in the economy? And what market and non-market mechanisms, such as trading or bartering in the Catan series, or selling as a trader in the Puerto Rico game, how do those affect how the game ends up? And so we can show that these games, which happen to be very much wonderful enjoyment games and a great deal of fun to play, are also directly aligned to the New York State Social Studies standards, and thus can provide another way for students to understand how economies work and to prepare for answering questions about economies on the New York State Region's exams. For more information about these curriculum alignment documents, the alignment to AASL's Standards for the 21st Century Learner, a discussion of how gaming fits within AASL's common beliefs, and alignment to some of the New York State learning standards, you can go to sls.gvboces.org/gaming. That's sls.gvboces.org/gaming.
Hi, how's it going? It's Eli, and today we're going to talk about the Wii some more. It's the most popular in libraries, and it's got a couple new services out there on the market, some of which have big implications for libraries, and some of which don't really fit into what's happening right now at libraries. So we're going to talk about these. First of all, we've got the WiiWare service. Now, as you may know, both Sony and Microsoft have a platform by which you can buy downloadable games online with real money, and you download the game and you put them onto your machine's hard drive, and then you have that game to play. It really is a game changer, no pun intended, in terms of the software market, because it allows people to create much smaller, simpler, more casual titles, which of course fits in really well to what libraries are doing for the most part. So now Nintendo's got a downloadable content service as well, in addition to the Wii Shop channel, which was primarily about old retail games. Now there's WiiWare, which is for games that have never been released for retail and are not available on disc or anything like that anywhere. There's a couple of different things about this service. First of all is that, you know, you use Wii points to buy it. A Wii point is basically a penny. So, you know, you have to buy your Wii points in multiples of 10 or 20, that kind of stuff. You have to use a credit card. It's kind of a pain for a library, but it can happen. Now, one of the less attractive things about the WiiWare service is that when you buy a game in WiiWare, you only get one download of it onto one Wii console. If you get deleted or something, you always own that title. You can download it again, but you can't install it onto more than one Wii for your purchase. That's in contrast to Sony's PlayStation Network, where you can actually install it between 3 and 5 times, depending on the title, onto different PlayStation 3s, which is a really nice service when you buy a little game. However, you know, as you may know, the Wii does not have a hard drive. It has a little flash chip inside there, which has some storage on it. But with some of these new downloadable games coming out, it's not really a problem yet. But for some people, it's starting to be a problem where you might run out of space on your Wii. And it's expected that at some point, there'll be some sort of external storage for the Wii and maybe a little USB hard drive, something like that. It remains to be seen how Nintendo's going to address that problem. But you better believe they're not going to let people buy themselves out of space on their Wii and then stop buying new downloadable titles. Now, the best thing about having a downloadable game service is that it opens up the market to really progressive, fun, casual little independent titles that don't cost $20 million to develop. And the launch titles really show a very interesting spectrum of different types of software that you might see on WiiWare in the future. So let's just kind of look at the launch titles. We'll talk about each one of them. First, we've got Pop, which is a really kind of cute, fun little puzzle game. You pop bubbles. It's a lot of fun to play. It's $7. It's nice because it supports up to 4 players and it has some pretty fun modes. It's nicely put together. There's not a lot of depth there, but it is kind of a fun little title for a small group. Another really great title that's come out is called Defend Your Castle. Now, this is available online. If you just search for Defend Your Castle, you can play the Flash version of it. What's really interesting about this is that the company that developed this game is a really tiny little company, and for them to be making a game that is now available for all the Wii owners is a big, big step for an independent game developer. Defend Your Castle is really fun. Basically, these little stick figures come running at your castle. They're called the Crayon Army because they're like drawn with crayon. You basically grab them and then you throw them away. And depending on where they land, they usually will die with a little scream, which is, of course, very satisfying, especially to certain age ranges. The coolest thing about Defend Your Castle, in addition to the fact that it's only $5, is that you get to, it's got this wonderful drop-in, drop-out play mechanic in that whoever points at the screen gets to be in the game for that round. You can just very easily have different players come in and come out, and whoever gets the most points that round gets to control how the points are spent in between rounds. It's a really fun little title, and what's really interesting is how they've taken this Flash game that anyone can play online and turned it into a unique title for the Wii with the addition of some really nice little content. It's kind of like what you're average 6-year-old boy would do in the Blue's Clues universe. That's, you know, try to stomp and smush and destroy and all that kind of stuff. So it's a very fun title. Then you've got Lost Winds. Lost Winds is a really interesting title. It's cooperative. It's a $10 game, and basically your little character flies around. You draw the breezes that you want to have them fly around on the screen. It's very Zelda-inspired, so it's got a lot of fun adventure elements. Not really good for tournaments or any sort of a event at the library, but it is an interesting title. Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles My Life as a King, which might win for the longest title. It's a really fun little game, although I can't quite explain why. Set out goals for your adventurers to do. You decide where the cities are going to go. You decide where your money gets spent, but you never leave the castle. And it's interesting because there's all these bosses and dungeons and things like that, and you never see any of it except if you go 4 levels deep into the text report that you get each morning. You can see what your adventurers were up to. And if you drill down far enough, you can see, oh, here they engaged this bad guy, and here's what happened this round, and they cast a spell. If you don't look, you never even see any of that stuff happening. So I'm totally addicted to this game. I can't explain it. I just want my city to be as nice as it possibly can be, and having a lot of fun playing it. Now, what's a little bit interesting about this title is it is the first title on Wii for which you can download additional content for, of course, an additional cost. Now, one way of looking at it is that this would have been a $50 game. That's, of course, the way they would like you to look at it. The other way of looking at it is that this is a game that comes with a cash register attached, and if you want to keep playing the game, you got to keep feeding it money. This is certainly a harbinger of future business models from the game industry, but for now, this is a really fun game to play for a single player, but something that really you're never really going to do at a library event. Now, there's another game that was one of the launch titles. It's called TV Show King, and it's basically a little quiz game that uses Miis. It's really cute. It's really nicely put together. It's $10. It's got 3,000 questions in it. Real gamers aren't going to be too enthralled with it because it's such a simple title. But non-gamers are going to be really enthralled with it, and it's a great thing for a senior night, a good thing for intergenerational stuff, but, you know, the trivia gamut can be a little bit of a problem depending on what type of generation you got playing. So then there's a casino blackjack game, not too interesting, other than the fact that WiiWare makes these games that you'd never have seen for $50 at retail happen. Since then, we've had a couple more titles be released. One is called Critter Roundup. It's kind of a weird little game, but it does support 4 players. There's Star Soldier R, which is a remake of Hudson's classic side-scrolling shooter. It's a really great title, but it's, you know, not the sort of thing you generally would do a lot at a tournament. There's also a new table tennis game. It's for 2 players, which is nice. Probably the most exciting recent release is Dr. Mario Online. And if you remember Dr. Mario, it was a very big puzzle game that followed in the wake of the Tetris juggernaut. It was also very popular with moms in the 80s, so that means it's popular with grandmas in the aughts. So then you've got up to 4 players for Dr. Mario Online. The fun things about it is that if you have Wii friends, people who are in your address book, you can send them the demo and play against them online, even if they don't actually purchase the full game. So that's a pretty cool little promotional tool they're doing there. So a lot of fun titles coming up on WiiWare. There should be some really great stuff over the next several months, kind of shaking up the spectrum of the titles out there and really giving some games that otherwise would not have made it into so many households a chance to be played. Now, to support WiiWare, Nintendo also recently released the Nintendo Channel. Now, the Nintendo Channel is a pretty interesting little thing, but it's primarily promotions. It's mostly videos and things like that. There's some good stuff in there, a lot of their television commercials, extended demos or video demos of different games, some playable demos, not a lot. By and large, most of the stuff that's in there is just video content. And it's cool, but it's not really a big deal for libraries, except there are some downloadable demos of DS games in there, which means you can hook up your Wii and offer a DS downloadable demo to the kids who come to your event, that they can open up their DS, download, and try this game. And it's kind of a cool role for libraries to say, hey, look, we're bringing you this stuff. You can try out these new games and see what you think. So that's kind of a neat idea, but it's mostly a promotional tool. Now, one of the things it's promoting most heavily is Nintendo's current new product, Wii Fit, which you've probably heard about. It's a game that has basically a 2-part scale, like a bathroom scale sort of thing that you stand on. It can detect your balance. It can detect how you're doing, you know, with your various yoga poses or push-ups or things like that. It's a unique title. Now, Wii Fit is the subject of Nintendo's largest advertising campaign they've ever mounted. And if you know Nintendo, they spend a lot on advertising. So this is a pretty big deal for them. Now, Wii Fit is cool. It's fun. It's a very light workout. It's got a little bit of controversy because they're using the BMI measurement, which results in 8-year-old girls being told that they're overweight by the Nintendo. And that's just not a good thing. But by and large, it's a really great title. It's kind of intended for the older audience. And the most interesting thing about it is it's a new peripheral, another new way to control games. And there's some demos or kind of mini games built into Wii Fit that kind of show the promise it could happen. One of them is a hula hoop game where you stand on it and you swing your hips and you got to keep a hula hoop going. It's really fun. The other is a snowboarding game where you kind of turn it sideways, lean forward and back, and try to keep yourself on track. You can also sort of see where this could go, and that there's a new retail title called Wii Ski that you can play with or without the balance board, standing on the balance board and holding the Wiimotes in your hands and kind of pretending to ski. So not too big a deal for libraries yet. It's hard to imagine any library having four balance boards and doing that kind of thing, but there are some interesting new ideas coming down the pike with that. Now, one more thing I just wanted to be sure to mention that's coming up soon in the Nintendo world is that Rock Band is coming out for Wii in June. If you bought a Wii for your library and were waiting to get a chance to get Rock Band, now's your chance. The only thing is that there's not going to be any downloadable content for it because there's not really room on the Wii to store full songs, similar to the PS2 version of Rock Band where you just get the songs that are on the disc. That's really the only problem with the most hardcore Rock Band players who want to play their favorite songs, even if it's an additional content. Not too big a deal. And there's supposed to be at some point Rock Band expansion discs which should have more songs on them. Rock Band is still probably about the most fun game that four players can play together. It's just a really great opportunity. It continues to be one of the most popular things here at my library. So that's about it for now. Talk to you next time and have a great day.
Hi there, this is Scott Nicholson, and I want to talk a little bit about rights, copyrights that is, and the rights of libraries to actually play these games. This is something that's been talked about a little bit, is it appropriate for a library to play these games that are designed for a single player in a home to play them in public? Is that okay? Now, we know with movies, a library can't just show a movie to the public. There's a license that they have to purchase. Does that extend to games? Is the game the same as a movie in this respect? There's been quite a bit of discussion on the internet about this recently. One of the things people point to is the EULA, the End User License Agreement, and that's what you agree to mess with a piece of software. And so if you want to play a game, an electronic game, then there's a EULA that is implied somewhere in there that's licensing the game so that you can play it. If you load up Dance Dance Revolution, for example, it tells you on the front screen that public performance of this game may not be okay, and you may have to contact the license holders of the music. Now, the question is what libraries are doing, is that deemed a public performance? Now, with movies, it certainly was. But what's the deal with games? In order to understand this a little more, I did a little bit of research into court law. In the past, the decisions about copyright have been decided in the courts. And so I found a case from 1996 that was Robert Allen versus the Academic Games League of America. And in this case, the Academic Games League of America were running, they were a nonprofit group, they were running games for kids, they were considered to be for educational purposes, they weren't charging for the games. Allen was the designer of these games, and he was suing these people and claiming that offering these games in public was considered to be a public performance of the game. So that sounds very much like what we have here, that in libraries, we're nonprofit organizations, that we are tying these games into education, learning, literacy. That's some of the research we're working on right now. The idea is that by having games in the library, it makes a more comfortable space for people to spend time. And when people spend time in book-rich environments, they end up being more literate. And so the question is this acceptable? Now, from this case law, and looking at this was from the U.S. Court of Appeals, and so I'm reading from the statement from the U.S. Court of Appeals from 1996. I have the full citation over on our website at gamesandlibraries.org. In their discussion of what public performance is, they conclude that the playing of a game is not a performance within the meaning of the Copyright Act. One of the things at issue here is the concept of play. And so is playing a game in public the same as a public performance? Now, the interpretation of play as used for movies and music in this decision was decided that it was different than the idea of play for a game. I'll quote, "The term play has not been extended to the playing of games. To do so would mean interpreting the Copyright Act in a manner that would allow the owner of a copyright in a game to control when and where purchasers of games may play the games, and this court will not place an undue restraint on consumers." They continue to say that games are meant to be played, that the games are being played by folks coming together for a competition, that it is a nonprofit corporation, the games are not available for a fee. The games were purchased legally, and in the tournaments, the libraries are the organizers of the event. They conclude the discussion of public performance by bringing in fair use, and they say that Fair use can be used for nonprofit educational purposes, and if the effect of use upon the potential market or value of the protected work is limited. In this decision, they said that the market has actually increased because of the exposure of players to games. So in this court decision, they deemed that the playing of these games did not constitute a public performance of the games. Now, a few caveats about this case. One, it's fairly old, and this was talking about board games, not talking about video games. And so the issue with many of these music games is the licensing of the music. So while there is some court law on our side that it's okay for us to do this, it hasn't yet been extended to dealing with music. When music is involved, licensed music is involved, is that a concern? Is that a problem? And this is where we are now. We don't know. This has not yet been tested. So we have court law on our side saying that the playing of games is not considered public performance. A few things to take from this. One is that you can't charge for the playing of games. If you charge for the playing of games, it's going to put you in a different category. So part of what was talked about here is that there was no cost involved. Second, that it's important to discuss the playing of games within this educational space. And within libraries, the way we present games is they're bringing people into the library and helping us expose patrons to other library services. Or that they are playing games that have various educational purposes, as Chris Harris has talked about, tying games into various learning standards. So this is part of what we're trying to explore and understand. Many bars actually have Guitar Hero and Dance Dance Revolution nights. If they have an ASCAP, the American Society of Composers, Authors, Publishers license, that's going to allow them to play music. And so they're going to be covered under this. Do libraries have to get this same kind of license? We don't know. So that's where we stand. We're in a world of we don't know. There is case law that supports that the playing of games in our setting is not considered a public performance, but those didn't involve licensed music. So at this point, the answer is we're not sure. Great! This is Scott, leaving you with ambiguity.
Hi, my name is Jenny Levine, and normally you can find me over at theshiftedlibrarian.com, my personal site where I write a lot about gaming and libraries. However, today I want to talk to you as an ALA staff member about some of the initiatives we have around gaming and libraries, because we've got a lot going on this year. The first thing that we have coming up, almost right on the horizon here, are some events at our big annual conference, which will be in Anaheim at the end of June. We're doing an open gaming night, which this is the first time ALA will have done open gaming for anyone at an annual conference. And that's going to take place the Friday night, June 27th, from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. at the Hilton. We'll have some snacks, we'll have some video games, we'll have some board games. It's going to be a lot of fun. The Verizon Foundation is underwriting the night, so we hope you'll come join us and have some fun with your colleagues and learn more about gaming and libraries. In addition, at conference, this is really exciting to me. We're going to be playing what is called a big game. And a big game is something that takes place out in the real world, where the physical objects of everyday life are the pieces of the game. And so at conference, what we'll be doing is running this game called California Dreaming, which is going to be like an information scavenger hunt. And there will be clues spread out across the conference campus. So in sessions, on the exhibit floor, in the hallways, you're going to be seeing clues for the game. And you can research the answer, find the answer, maybe you know the answer, and you can either bring it to game headquarters in the new gaming pavilion on the exhibit floor, or you can text it to us. And we'll be tracking individual leaders, but we'll also be tracking teams. There are going to be six teams playing: academic librarians, public librarians, school librarians, special librarians, students, and the Library Society of the World. And you can sign up ahead of time for a team, and you'll get a colored sticker that where you can help show your affiliation. And that way you can identify other players on your team as you're moving around conference. And there will be one of these teams at the end will have answered the most questions and claimed the most territory and will be announced as the winner. And we're going to have some pretty cool prizes for the individual team leaders. where you have some stuff from the Cartoon Network, Electronic Arts, the game publisher, Microsoft, and some others. So this is something that's designed to help you connect with other conference attendees and have fun during conference. If you go to wikis.ala.org/annual2008, you can sign up for the big game. It's completely free. In addition, we have some gaming sessions that will be taking place on the program, and those are all listed on that same wiki. And again, we have, for the first time, a gaming pavilion on the exhibit floor, so you can start meeting some of the game vendors there. So we encourage you to stop by and learn more about their products. So that's right on the horizon. That's coming up. After that, we have the 2008 TechSource Gaming, Learning, and Library Symposium coming up. Now, last year this was a very successful event. We had 300 people attend, and we've capped registration at 350 this year. And we expect to sell out, so if you're at all interested in coming, we highly recommend that you register now. And registration is open. You can go to gaming.techsource.ala.org and find out more about the event and a link to register. The call for presenters is out now, so if you have a session you'd like to do, feel free to send us a proposal. But I can tell you that we have some big name keynote presenters. The opening keynote is going to be from Mark Prensky, who's one of the thought leaders for gaming and education, and Dr. Lawrence Kuttner, who, if you listen to the previous podcast, Beth Galloway did a review of his new book, Grand Theft Childhood. It's getting a lot of press. I'm reading it right now, and I can verify everything Beth said in the review. It's very informative. Research is well done. And it's nice that it addresses the extremes, but it really puts us in the middle ground where we can actually act on the information. So you can hear him speak in person. And then we also have Andrew Bubb from GamerDad.com. And Andrew is a parent. He's a gaming parent, and at the website he offers a lot of advice for other parents about which games are appropriate and how to talk to kids about games, and so he's going to give us that perspective. So again, I encourage you to register and come join us, and look forward to seeing you there. Almost directly after that, on November 15th, is National Gaming and Libraries Day. Now, we did a trial run of this in April, so it may sound familiar. So this will be a nationally coordinated event to play games in libraries. And we're going to be using the GT system, which is a product of Ann Arbor District Library in Michigan. And this will be an online leaderboard where any library can sign up, and we'll coordinate a national video game tournament. And so kids at your library will be able to compete against kids at other libraries and then see the results on the web. So for the first time, we're going to have a national leaderboard. But it's not just going to be video games, it's going to be board games too. So we're going to try to coordinate as many people as possible playing the same board game in libraries across the country. We're going to try to set our own record for this. So we have some exciting partnerships that are forming around this event, and I'll probably talk more about those in the next podcast. But suffice it to say, I think everybody's going to be really amazed at what comes out of this day. So that's a sense of some of the specific things we have coming up. I just want to mention that as kind of a framework for all of this, the Verizon Foundation has given ALA almost $1 million to explore gaming, libraries, and literacy. And we've just started this grant over the last couple of months. It's going to run through the end of 2009. And we're going to be building a toolkit of best practices, tips, etc., out on the open web for any library to use. We're going to be working with the Library Game Lab, run by Scott Nicholson out at Syracuse University, to do some research and measure outcomes and put some numbers behind these things. So we're very excited about this. We're very grateful to the Verizon Foundation. And you know, I should mention, too, that they're also underwriting part of the Gaming Symposium. So they are big believers in what we're doing with these initiatives, and we really appreciate their support on it. So that's a quick overview of what's going on at ALA with gaming. If you want to keep track of what we're doing, you can go to our blog at gaming.ala.org/news. You can also see the wiki where we're starting to build some of the resources for the toolkit. That's at gaming.ala.org/resources. And we're going to have a public face for National Gaming Day, which will be at ilovelibraries.org/gaming. Now, what you see when you go there still refers to the April date, but very soon you'll start seeing information for the November date. So we look forward to hearing feedback from you. If you have any questions, please feel free to contact us. You can email me personally at jlevine@ala.org, and hope to game with you soon. Thanks.
Well, you've made it to another end of a Games and Libraries podcast. To find the show notes from this show with a lot of the links that are talked about, head over to gamesandlibraries.org. I want to remind you at ALA on the 28th, which is Saturday, from 10 to noon at the Sheridan Park Hotel in Plaza AB, that will be the meeting of the Games and Gaming Member Initiative Group. And so come, we'll talk about what we want to do with this group. It'll be the first meeting of this group because we just started it at midwinter, so this is going to be a pretty exciting time. And many of the folks who've talked in this podcast will be at ALA, be at the Open Gaming Night, at some of the other activities, so come by, say hi, let us know if you're listening to this, if you made it this far, and we'll keep the fires burning for you. Thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye. We'd like to thank the Verizon Foundation and the American Library Association for supporting this podcast.